You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
My name is Bill Thomas. I'm a writer, consulting producer, and now podcaster. I am now trying to use my experience as the brother of a murder victim to help other victims of violent crime. I'm working on a book on the unsolved Colonial Parkway murders, and I'm the co-administrator of the Colonial Parkway murders Facebook group together with Kristen Dilley.
My name is Kristen Dilley. I'm a writer, a researcher, a teacher, and a victim's advocate, as well as the social media manager and co-administrator for the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page with my partner in crime, Bill Thomas.
Hello, and welcome back to Mind Over Murder. I'm Bill Thomas.
And I'm Kristen Dilley.
We'd like to thank you again for joining us. We have some more good news. We've just crossed over 14,000 downloads.
Woohoo!
We very much appreciate your support. It really does mean a lot to us. And this is the part when I ask you again to please rate us, review us, and please tell your friends about Mind Over Murder.
So Bill, there have been two interesting cases here in Virginia that I've been following. And because I've put them up on our social media ad nauseum, you have been following them too.
I had no choice.
Unfortunately, that's kind of how things roll with us. Whatever I'm following, he's following, and vice versa.
It's true.
So we had two cases, one of which just unfolded over Friday, and then the other of which goes back a week. The first case, which is that of Levi Norwood, a 17-year-old junior from Liberty High School in Northern Virginia. On Friday, he shot and killed his mother, Jennifer, and his younger brother, Wyatt, 6 years old, when his father came home and found him standing over his family with a loaded gun, he shot and wounded his father, Joshua. Now, luckily, Dad was able to escape and call for help and is currently being treated in the hospital, stable condition. Levi then escaped, stole a Camry, and headed for North Carolina. He was arrested in Durham, North Carolina, after shoplifting hair dye, clothing, and a backpack from an undisclosed location. They have not given that information out in terms of where he was found. Just a very disturbing case, speaking as someone who works with teenagers on the regular. Cannot even imagine what would have prompted a young man to do this, especially because by all accounts here that I've been reading in the media, none of his friends noticed anything strange or out of the ordinary about him on Friday at school.
I think we're talking about profound mental illness, but not something that was necessarily easily diagnosed. My first two thoughts were of just how tragic this has been for this family. And then, you know, my mind went to abuse and serious, serious mental illness. I'm sure we'll find out more as this case unfolds. It's just tragic.
There really are no words at this point beyond tragic that I think you can use for something like this. And if one very sort of sensational murder case involving teenagers was not enough, Northern Virginia also saw a second case, not teenagers this time, but young adults. Last weekend, there was the murder of Ayanna Griffin, age 19, and Natumba Bianda, age 21. Ayanna was from Alexandria, Virginia. Natumba was from Germantown, Maryland. And they were found dead on the median of Route 58 near a silver Nissan Maxima, and they'd been shot in the head. Originally, you know, this was responded to as potentially a car accident, but once it became clear that they had been murdered and were not dead as a result of the car accident, there was, of course, a search for the perpetrator. The perpetrator turned out to be an 18-year-old senior from T.C. Williams High School with the name of Muhammad Ali. No motive has been apparent in this, but he does have a preliminary hearing scheduled for April 15th.
Again, a very sad case, and we don't know exactly what transpired.
Correct. We don't know if there's a relationship between the victims and the perpetrator. There's still very, very little understood about that at this point.
On a more optimistic note, we've been very excited to see a number of cases broken across the country using investigative genetic genealogy, or as some people are calling it, forensic genealogy. This is where unidentified victims or unidentified perpetrators are being ID'd through the use of genealogical databases. We're really excited about this technology, and something we're going to be planning on talking about in the coming week here on Mind Over Murder is, how does all this work? How can all of us support investigative genetic genealogy, and how can we help solve America's 200,000 cold case murders?
If you are following our social media pages, such as the Colonial Parkway murders, you will notice that we post a lot of articles about cases that have been broken with forensic genealogy. So if you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Bill, our other social media pages are?
They are. Well, we've got the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page and now our new Mind Over Murder Facebook page. We hope you'll follow both. Our new Mind Over Murder, or sometimes called Murder Over, Twitter handle, as well as my Twitter handle, BillThomas56. We really encourage and appreciate your following us, your support. One of the things we would love to see more of are your comments about what you'd like us to cover on Mind Over Murder. There are so many different opportunities, fascinating cases, and Kristen and I are trying to sort out all the amazing people that we've been so lucky to meet over these last few years. How do we get them all to fit into a schedule? We want to cover cases, and we also want to introduce you to some of these amazing people who are helping solve them.
We've got so much to offer, but we definitely want your comments, your questions, and cases that you'd like for us to take a look at so that we can continue to grow our podcast audience and grow our podcast.
So with all that said, I think it's on with the show. What do you think?
I think that sounds pretty good.
Thanks again. Our guest this week is working CSI Cheryl Mack McCollum from Atlanta. In addition to being a longtime crime scene investigator, Mack is also a lecturer and professor who has taught any number of college and grad level programs in crime scene investigation. She's also the founder of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, CCIRI. Which is an organization she founded in 2004, which helps professionals in criminal justice get advanced training and techniques in solving unsolved murders, kidnappings, and missing persons cases. The Cold Case Investigative Research Institute is comprised of over 600 experts and 5,000 student volunteers from colleges and universities around the world. Most people call her Mac, and we will too. Both of us are big fans, and we're very pleased to welcome Cheryl Mack McCollum to Mind Over Murder.
You're listening to Mind Over Murder. I'm your host, Kristen Dilley.
And I'm your host, Bill Thomas.
And today we are on with very special guest, Cheryl Mack McCollum, a crime scene investigator from Atlanta. Mack, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank y'all so much. This is so exciting for me.
So why don't you start a little bit by talking to us about how you got involved in your work with CSI?
Well, literally my whole life, I've been interested in criminal justice and just wanted to be in the thick of it. So anytime there was some action, I didn't want to be on the sidelines. So that's how I got involved.
And then where did you get your start working as a crime scene investigator?
Well, my start goes way back. 1983, I started working at Grady Hospital in their Rape Crisis Center. And Grady is our largest downtown hospital, and they serve everybody and anybody. If the president is visiting and there's a problem with the president, he goes to Grady. If there's somebody that's traveling through and is harmed on the interstate somehow, an arrest or some other way, they go to Grady. It was probably some of the best training I ever had in my life. And the reason I did it, even though I was still in high school, is I was so itching just to get started. And I wanted to work with a detective, and I wanted to work actual cases. But there was no way at 18 I could do that other than to volunteer at Grady. And then I was assigned a sex crimes detective, and we worked the cases together. So I took the victim advocate part of it and tried to get good witness statements and good descriptions of perpetrators and things like that, and, you know, help the victims understand how important it's going to be to speak to law enforcement. And so I worked hand in hand with Detective Black for almost 2 years, and literally some of the best training ever, my whole career.
Now, a question that people ask us a lot now, Mac, is they're very interested in forensics work. Obviously, the explosion in forensic genealogy is part of it, but what would your suggestion be when you deal with young people through the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute and your work? How do you suggest that people get involved in the field?
I literally give them the same advice that I gave myself. Go volunteer. Go see what grooves you, what excites you the most that you literally would do and have done for free. So if you think you want to work in a prison, go find out. If you think you want to work crime scene, go find out. But the first thing they need to do is understand what forensics is. Because I have a lot of students come to me and they go, oh, I'm going to go into forensics. What does that mean? Because it doesn't have the same meaning for me that it may have for the two of you or that it may have for Joe Scott Morgan. So define for me what that means to you. Do you want to work in a lab? Do you want to be a detective? Do you want to be a crime scene investigator? Do you want to be an advocate? So again, you got a lot of civilians that are in forensics. You've got a lot of people that wear badges that are in forensics. You've got people that started like the genealogy. When they first got into that field, fighting crime never crossed their mind. So there you go. I mean, it happens. There are people that have an expertise forensically in tattoos. So the inks are different. The type of style that you might have a koi fish versus a tribal tattoo versus a prison tattoo. They're going to be able to explain that to you. I have a knot tying expert. He started out as a sailor. And then he became more interested in people that ride horses and, you know, how the Boy Scouts are trained and how people in the armed services are trained. Anything from neckties to tying up your horse, he can tell you all about it. But he never thought he was going to be a crime fighter in any way. But he can tell you a lot by the way a victim is tied up. He can tell you about the perpetrator. So again, it's real important to understand what you mean by forensics.
And your suggestion would be before you go out and look at a two-year course or a four-year course or working full-time in the field is to start out as a volunteer.
Absolutely. You're going to know in 5 minutes either whether you want to do that ever again or not. There are people that take a tour of a prison, and that door shutting behind them, that iron slam, they either love it or hate it. So go find out. Find out if working in a hospital is for you. Find out if, you know, you can take blood, if you can take screaming, if you can take chaos and insanity. Find out. Because watching TV is fabulous. It is breezy. The shows are fantastic. But when you're doing it for real, it's got elements that TV can't give you.
And one thing I've noticed is the people on the CSI shows are much more glamorously dressed than the real life folks that work in the field.
Now I resent that. I look fabulous every day.
No, I should be clear
I've got
here.
I've got my hose and my, you know, leather skirt. Are you kidding?
Well, and the 4-inch heels, you were cutting a glamorous figure. I take it all back.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, if you're not wearing 4-inch heels, I don't know that you could work a thing. That's how you need to be at all times. You know, it's kind of funny because CSI Atlanta, I'm working with Karen Greer, and she is flawless day and night. And I used to joke and I would tell people, look, those CSI shows, man, they're no good because there's no way you could wear, you know, again, the high heels and the leather skirt and walk the scene with me. Honey, she not only has done it, she's done it in Gucci boots. She's done it in 4-inch heels. She's done it in a Chanel, you know, ball gown, basically. So it can be done. I've seen it. Wasn't an active scene, but she certainly has worked that and walked that scene with me more than once. So I have seen it.
Well, since we are on the subject of CSI Atlanta, can you talk to us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, I'm super excited about it. So Karen Greer, for those that are listening that don't know her, she's an Emmy award-winning anchor in Atlanta. She's an investigative reporter. She is just a remarkable human being. I've known Karen probably 20 years, and I've never known anybody that didn't just adore her. You cannot be around her without just falling in love with her. So she calls me, and Natasha Lee, her producer, says, hey, we want to talk to you about some cold cases we want to maybe try to highlight on the news. I said, fantastic, I'm there. So I go down to the station, and I meet with them. And they said, well, what would you do on this case or that case? And so I was telling them, you know, that, you know, fantasy world, if I could do whatever on this case, I would do this. On this case, I would call in this person. On this case, I would test with this tool. And so by the time I left there, they had asked me would I pair with Sharon in highlighting some of these cases and really working them, not just, you know, telling the stories again, which are important. It is so important to keep the stories out there, remind people that we still need things solved and all that. More important, try to solve the thing. So I couldn't say yes fast enough. And we've been going about 8 months, and I have had the time of my life. It is so much fun. They're a great group of folks over there. They truly are doing it for the right reason. I'm not a media person. I'm not a journalist. I'm not a reporter. So it's not like we're going to show up and try to get the victim crying and all that sort of stuff. It's literally, hey, what can we do on this case? Who do I know that can help us? So we've done, for example, an age progression where Kelly from the GBI has come out and helped us, and she is just a superb human being and literally has a gift beyond measure. Dr. Laura Petler has come out and helped me. Holly Hughes has come out. Literally everybody I've called so far has gone out of their way to say yes. Detective Christine Menina came all the way down from Indianapolis. What do you need? Karen Smith has offered, anytime you need anything, call me. If you just want to bounce an idea off, let me know. People often ask me, and I, you know, they're so funny about it, because they're like, how after all these years are you not burnt out? Are you not, you know, tired of dealing with such sadness? Well, I'm going to go ahead and answer that before y'all even ask me if you're going to ask me that. And I just gave you an example of how I could not possibly be burnt out if I tried. I've got the best people in the world offering to help me at all times. I am surrounded literally by heroes. So when you have these cases where there's literally a killer still walking around and you've got somebody like Phil sitting there that needs help, how in the world do you not get up and go, okay, we're going to try to do something about it?
So when you're talking with your fellow experts on CSI Atlanta, are you talking about real life cases that are currently unsolved?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we'll take a case like Lover's Lane or the Missing and Murdered Children or Mary Shotwell Little or Ricola Coleman, whatever the case is, Danny Stowe. So we contact the family, we contact the police, we say, look, we got to try to find this evidence, and we got to try to find this witness, and why don't we offer a polygraph? Or, hey, have you retested the evidence? So a lot of times it's just a matter of letting the new detective that might be 30 who really hasn't known that much about the case, have you heard of the newest and latest technology? Do you know what phenotyping is? Have you yourself learned how to do the genealogy? Do I need to give you somebody's name? Because here's the really fantastic part to me. We might kickstart it, and we might highlight, and we can give them a roadmap to say, look, you need to call Jared Bradley, or you need to call Francine Bardot. Because they are such wonderful people, I got their number in my phone. Or if I feel like, you know what, I think this scene is staged, but you don't got to take my word for it. Let's get Dr. Petler over here. He will come here and help you. I mean, extraordinary people. And then if I think there's a case, and we've done this too, where the Atlanta crime, we believe, has a component outside the state of Georgia. So I'll call Nancy Grace and say, hey, can you put this nationwide? And she does.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about Nancy for a second. How did you become involved with Nancy on a professional level?
I'm working a crime scene. It's about 2:45 in the morning, heat of summer, and we got the crime scene tape up and everything, and we're in what we call the bluff. But this little sports car comes flying. And I'm talking about with no regard for their own safety, much less anybody else's. Fly in sideways, the door flings open, and this little bitty woman gets out, and she's like, what's going on? What's happening? Who needs something? What can I do? And I didn't know who she was. And I'm like, who in the world is that? And Jim Burns from the GBI went, oh, that's Nancy Gray. She's the district attorney.
And she's and she's tiny. She's this very small person.
She's tiny. And I'm like, what? Because at that time, you're talking about maybe 1990, the district attorneys never left the courthouse. They were Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, baby. That's it. They stayed in that golden tower, right? They didn't come to crime scenes. That's something that's done today if the crime scene is major and there is a DA that's perhaps on call if you have a question, but she was doing it literally before anybody else was doing it in her own car on her own time. No vest, no radio, no nothing. So I knew two things in that moment, because what she did at that scene, and I've told it many times, but there was a house with a detached garage. We had a warrant for the house. We're searching it. And then somebody says, I bet he stashed what we need in that garage. And officers are walking toward that garage, and she stopped. And she said, you need a second warrant for that garage. It's not attached to that house. It's separate. And we were like, oh, good Lord, it's crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. Fortunately, we listened to her. We held the scene until they went and got a separate warrant for the attached garage, and it saved the case. But I knew, oh, it saved, no doubt. But I knew in that moment that not only was this going to be somebody that I was going to be lucky enough to work with, that she was fit to make all of my cases better, but that we were going to be friends. And I've been very fortunate that she was my assistant district attorney when I was with the Crime Commission assigned to the Major Case Division. So we got to work every major case in Atlanta together until she abandoned us for court visits.
Now, this was 30 years ago when you first met.
Yes.
You were a mere lass, really. You were a kid.
Oh, I was.
A mere child.
Mere child. Yep. We had a ball. And let me say this, because I don't know, last year at CrimeCon, but it was kind of funny, but this woman who I don't know walked up to me and said, I've heard of you. You're the one that rides next to Grace's coattail. And so my sisters and I were standing there, and my sisters immediately look at me like, ooh, I bet Carol's about to dog touch this woman, you know. But I looked at her, and I smiled, and I went, you're damn right. Because here's what I know to be true. Nancy Gray could have any crime scene investigator in this country on her show. She could have any crime analyst or cold case expert on her show. She, because she is a tremendous friend, has me on her show. I understand that. I get it. And I am deeply appreciative to her loyalty. Because, again, she didn't have to do that. She didn't have to have me on Court TV. She didn't have me, you know, have to have me on the Nancy Gray show for 15, 20 years. She didn't have to do that, y'all. Because, again, she can pick the phone up and ask anybody. And they'll be like, yes, please, I want to be on your show.
Of course, but she wants the best. And she has known you for 30 years. So, you know, she's got you on speed dial as it is.
Well, I appreciate that. But y'all know what I'm saying. And that's a side of her people need to know. She is fiercely loyal. She is fiercely sweet and kind. She's one of those people that, yes, she has a persona on TV, and that is a true and accurate part of her. Because I'm going to tell you something. If somebody harms somebody, and they rape somebody or murder somebody or stab somebody or set somebody on fire, it angers her. And my question for people is, why in the world doesn't it anger you? Mm-hmm. When they say, oh, she's just so over the top about things, you should be over the top too. We should all be doing something to stop this evil in the world, period.
Absolutely.
But the other side of her is that friend that calls you after 35 years and says, hey, I remember this is the anniversary of this. Or, hey, please tell Walt this, I thought of him. Or, hey, I know Huck's graduating, I'm going to send this, you know, whatever y'all need. Oh, I thought of Caroline, they sent me this cool thing, but I want to send her one. That's the real Nancy Gray. I'm just telling you. She is a Georgia girl. She knows where she's from. She's confident where she's from. And she loves her mama. She loves her family. And she loves her state. And she will fight for you to the end. And I don't know why everybody don't love her.
I pointed out in one of our earlier episodes on Mind Over Murder that I'd had a chance to meet Nancy through you at CrimeCon, and that Nancy was so absolutely lovely in person, and then she had me with you on her show. And as I pointed out, the only people she's ever mean to are criminals and maybe sleazy defense attorneys. That's it.
Yep.
She's absolutely lovely to everybody else. So this idea that she's scary is pretty far from accurate. I think she's only scary if you're a bad guy.
Correct.
So let's switch to kind of a nuts and bolts question from your perspective as a longtime CSI Mac. What types of evidence do you feel like there are most useful to you when you're working a crime scene?
There's two kinds. The ones that are the most obvious. You want the weapon. You want the blood. You want the seminal fluid. You want the ripped up photographs. You want the threatening letter.
One of the most frequent questions we're asked here at Mind Over Murder is, how can I help?
Thanks to Othram, a leading forensic DNA testing lab for law enforcement, you can get involved and help solve real cases.
If you have tested at a consumer genetics company, you can contribute your data to DNASolves.com. The process is easy and confidential, just two simple steps. Your DNA might be the missing piece that helps solve the identity of an unknown person.
Then Mind Over Murder will highlight cases Othram is working on to seek your crowdfunding support for DNA testing to help solve these cold cases.
Upload your DNA profile to DNASolves.com. It's easy, free, and confidential.
Then join Mind Over Murder as we help families find answers with Othram and DNASolves.com.
All those things. The other things that are really critical are the things that you might pick up because you don't know how they fit yet. So you may walk in a scene and everything is just immaculate except one room. Well, that room will become my focus. Or everything is, you know, kind of lived in except the kitchen counter is now spotless and perfect. Well, that will become my focus. So if you're working a scene, again, some things are going to be routine and obvious. You want to swab the door handles. You want to get the fingerprints. You want to get the blood. You want to get all that stuff. But then you want to take a minute and look around. Is there a piece of mail that's addressed to somebody else that is not out of place? It may even be on the desk. Take it. Look in the mailbox. Take it. Look in the trash can. Take it. You can go through it later. You can figure out whether it's relevant or not later. But I'm a big proponent in both of those things.
So it's a lot about situational awareness and just sort of taking in the whole picture and not just focusing on the most obvious things, like you're saying, the weapon, the blood, you know, the things that probably initially grabbed your attention.
Yeah, I try to. I mean, I try to stay outside even. Let's say you have a crime scene in a home. I'm going to stand in the middle of the street and I'm going to look up and down and I'm going to take pictures up and down. What cars are out there? Is there a basketball goal? Has the trash been picked up or not? Are all the trash cans and all the driveways except for two? Why are they not pulled down? Is somebody out of town? Or do they not do it for some reason? And I will send a rookie to go look in the trash cans that aren't pulled down. And then I'm going to look at the house. Is there a wreath on the house? Are there flowers everywhere? Are there nice curtains I can see? Is anything busted? What type of person might live here? And I'm going to try to understand that victim before I even get to the front door as much as I can. And then once I get in, and I like to go in alone, I don't want anybody else to tell me what I'm going to see. I want to tell myself what I'm going to see based on what the scene is telling me. So I try to really make sure I'm not telling the scene what happened. The scene's telling me what happened. So I really try to take my time, and I take a whole lot more pictures than people think are necessary. But, you know, sometimes you go back and go, oh, I didn't even notice the fish tank. You know, with something like that, where then you go back and go, that tells me something I might not have known about this. So everything is relevant. Everything is relevant, whether I know how it fits yet or not.
So it sounds like you do need to have a good understanding of human psychology as well.
I mean, it doesn't hurt. I mean, I'm one of those, I believe we should cross-train in a whole lot of stuff. And I think you need to have an understanding about a lot of things just because it can help you. And some of that comes from living past 25 or 35 or 45 or 55. It all helps. And it helps having a diverse group at the scene. It helps having a diverse group to talk about afterwards. It just really does. And I'm a big believer in that. Debrief, debrief, debrief. Everybody at the end of it to talk. What did you see? What do you think? How does this fit? Because if three of us believe something and then two other people saw it completely different, we need to go back. Because clearly somebody missed something. We misinterpreted or misunderstood, and it would be really important to go back and make sure we're all on the same page.
What do you think is the most challenging case you've worked on from an investigative standpoint?
I mean, I've had a lot that are challenging for a lot of reasons. I mean, the Olympic Park bombing was mine for 7.5 minutes till the FBI showed up. That was challenging because it was so chaotic and so new to us. And we felt like we were, you know, almost in the middle and kind of victimized as well. Another thing that was difficult for me was the courthouse shooting, and that was difficult for me because it was my department, and I lost not only a friend that day and a colleague, but a judge and a court reporter that I admired very much. And ironically, that was my last day with the Fulton County Sheriff's Department, and there are a lot of them that are difficult, but I think a lot, you know, stay with you for various reasons. But like, for example, Mary Shotwell Little is difficult, and she's difficult because we don't have a body. I believe she's murdered, you know, but we haven't been able to prove that. So again, the Adamsville slaying, I mean, that was difficult for me because we had 7 members of the same family that perished in that, and a little boy that, you know, had to play dead to survive. And we didn't think he was alive for a long time.
What are some of the challenges that come up, you know, for an investigator when there is no body to use to help, you know, move a prosecution forward?
The first thing you have to do is determine whether or not a crime has been committed. And sometimes that's very difficult. And you actually do that with every case. But you've got to make sure you actually have a crime, because it is not illegal to disappear. I mean, after 36 years together, if Walt McCollum wised up and decided, hey, I'm out of here, he can do that.
Somehow I can't see that. I can't see that happening.
I don't see that happening.
He could just start walking down the road. He doesn't have to tell me or the kids or his mom or my sister or anybody. He can just go start a new life, and he has committed no crime. So the first thing we have to do is make sure that happens. I would say the next thing that would be pretty imperative is collect everything. You want that cell phone data. You want the computers. You want social media stuff. Mm-hmm. Any computer they use, work or at home, even if they have a volunteer job or a second type job, if they're a deacon at a church and use that computer, go search that computer. They may search something there that they didn't at home. So you want to, you know, try to get that footprint, try to understand what is their routine, what do they normally do, what do they like, what do they not like. Do they go to the gym every single day at 7:30, and are they at work by 9? But they haven't been doing that on Wednesday. That might be a clue. What's happening Wednesday morning? We got to find out where they were going on Wednesday. You know, that sort of thing. So it's really important that you gather that stuff quickly so that you can understand it. The other thing that's really difficult is we go through our daily lives right now that you're not on camera all the time. Every time you pass a school, you're on camera. Every time you pass an ATM, a gas station, a lot of churches now. Most of your neighbors may have that Ring doorbell. You're on camera a lot when you go into Home Depot, when you go into Walmart, when you go into Walgreens, when you go to your church, when you go to the filling station, you're on camera. And then you may be at a ball field where 15 people are taking a video of you and you're unaware of it just because they're filming the game and you happen to be in the background. Difficult for people to just walk away and hide without at least having some footage of them leaving. It's really hard. It's possible, but it's more and more difficult. We have a camera system in our city that can pick your car tag up from the minute you hit our city to the minute you leave it. Those are tools that, you know, law enforcement is going to use. I love getting as much of their routine as I can. And any void and pattern is where I'm going to start to concentrate. That's really important. The other thing is you got to sit at some point and start connecting these dots. Have they moved any money? Have they, in recent years, maybe put some money in a safety deposit box? Did they go to the safety deposit box recently? Have they had affairs? Have they had contact with somebody that they used to be friends with in childhood and they started talking about, yeah, we got to go to Montana hunting? Anything that could give you a clue that they're about to take off would be really important. The other thing that I always tell rookies, you can work a missing persons case, but it's almost imperative that you work a missing persons case as a homicide. A lot of people do a dual investigation. They will do a missing person at the same time they're doing a search and recovery. For me, if you work it as a homicide, that means you're collecting everything as perfectly as you possibly can. No stone unturned kind of thing. You're not going to leave a cigarette butt. You're not going to leave a piece of mail. You're not going to let that get away from you. So it's really important that you work that case as seriously as you can from the beginning, because time is imperative, as you know. When you've got a homicide case, they like to say first 48. And after the first 48, the ability for you to solve it drops dramatically. In a missing persons case, it's the first 3 hours are the most critical, because whatever is going to happen to that person typically happens in the first 3 hours. So if they're going to be sexually assaulted, it's already happened. if they're going to be murdered, it's already happened. It's rare that people are kept past that time. Again, we all know it happens, but I'm saying it's so rare that mathematically it's not even factored in. So you work that case hard as you can, as fast as you can, and as though it's a homicide. And of course, pray that you're wrong.
So the safe assumption then is to assume that someone's been killed and do the complete top-to-bottom investigation. And then if you're wrong and it turns out they reappear, says, well, I just wanted to get away for a couple of days. Poor Walt. Then he comes home and all is right with the world and he wasn't murdered.
Right. Listen, I tell people all the time, I love to be wrong because I don't play this game as, oh, I'm sure they're fine. I'm sure they just went to Atlantic City with some buddies and they'll be back. If you've got somebody that's never done that, they have no history of affairs or leaving for 2 or 3 days. They have no drug problem, no alcohol problem, no gambling problem. They're not known to frequent prostitutes. They don't have any history of run-ins with the law. You have to accept that for what it is and not just say, well, I'm sure he'll turn up. Call us after a day or two. You know, there's things you can do. Go ahead and get people searching for a car. Go ahead and get people at least to say on the radar, you know, anybody see this vehicle and see this person, let us know. They could be hurt. They could be on the side of the road. You know, so it's just, to me, it's imperative to get on with it. And if we're wrong, no harm, no foul. We had a case not long ago where I probably took 1,000 photographs and it turned out not to be what we thought it was. That's just a good training then. That's a good training, right? Did I take the proper photographs? Did I take them the right way? Did I take them enough? Are they the right angle? Are they in focus? So, I mean, it's all good. I mean, you just say, we're happy this person is okay and glad it wasn't something, you know, harmful. And we all came together. We all did the right thing. If this was real, what could we do better next time? And that's what you do.
Besides, they were digital photographs anyway.
Amen. And cost me nothing. Right on.
So one of the things that we were kind of joking about earlier was, you know, CSI. And we know that shows like that have really shaped people's understanding about forensics. What are some of the things that CSI gets wrong that you'd like to clear up right now?
I would love to clear up that things are not as rapid as it appears on TV.
Okay. I figured that was going to be one of them. Yeah.
I mean, I wish it was. I mean, I wish I could get blood back in 30 minutes. I wish I could do a fingerprint right that very second. I would love to have that computer where the screen looks like it's just iridescent in the air, you know, they can move it with their finger and all that. I would love that. I don't have it. I would love to have basically Google Earth where I've got the map and the house and I can see it and I can stick hands in it and know where the perpetrator's car is going and put a drone in the air to follow him. That's not reality.
Right.
I can't do it.
Right.
You know, there are things that you see on TV sometimes and watching it is very entertaining and it's fabulous. And you're like, yeah, right. They didn't even have a warrant. Like, you can't do that. Or they're clearly violating somebody's civil rights, you know, when they do certain things. But, you know, for the most part, it's a two-edged sword because on the one hand, your juries are so much more advanced in their understanding of what can be done and what frankly should be done. But sometimes they put too much on us, meaning we had a woman in a case that just as a juror could not understand why we had not fingerprinted the brick. And she kept saying it and kept saying it apparently in the jury room. Well, we never talked about that on the stand because we thought it was clear you can't. You know, it's porous, first of all, and with all the, you know, ridges and holes and all that, you're not going to get a fingerprint of any quality off this particular brick that we had. So we swabbed it for DNA, but we didn't do the fingerprint, right?
Right.
Couldn't get off of that. So that's unfortunate. But she knew enough that in certain situations, they might could possibly get a partial somehow, some way, that not us in that particular instant with that particular brick. But it was not even something we were even asked because nobody's going to do that. You know, in that regard, I'm going for the DNA anyway. because I know that's a better shot than the fingerprint. Does that make sense? So you have two teams you're basically battling. You have the defense and you have the jury. And they both have their own set of questions, but only one can really question you. But you know everybody else is over there saying, well, you know, she said she only has a master's degree. Good Lord. Well, my job only requires a high school diploma. But that's not the way it comes off. They want everybody to have this PhD, and they want everybody to be like Criminal Minds. Well, baby, I ain't got no PhD. Ain't going to get no PhD. But I do know what I'm talking about. And I promise you, I've done the most thorough job that I know to do. But sometimes when I'm only asked yes or no questions, I don't get a chance to explain and, you know, really convey my heart and tell people how hard I worked on this case. All I get asked is, did you print the brick? No. Thank you.
So do you feel like this so-called CSI effect, does that make it harder to get a conviction in a court of law these days?
If people have already made their mind up, I mean, there's article after article. It's a real thing. There's no question there's a CSI effect. But in some ways, I like the bar to be raised. I just want it to be where there's no question that things are done properly. But when you put expectations up there that just aren't realistic, I mean, I don't have an MBAT that I can take to the field. So if somebody's upset because I didn't use the MBAT, I don't have one. If I see it, I would use it. But that's just not a reality for me right now at my department. Does that make sense?
Does anyone else in the Atlanta area have an MBAC? Is it the sort of thing you would have access to?
Absolutely. Our crime lab has one. That was just an example that people think in my truck is everything. It's not. It's not realistic that I would have that. It's not even necessary that I would have that. If I collect the evidence properly, I can get it to the crime lab who has one. But I'm just saying, if I'm asked a yes or no question, you know, did you do this? Did you do that? And I just have to keep saying no. I'm only asking you yes or no. I don't get a chance to really explain it. And the jury's like, well, good Lord, what'd she do? Nothing? You know?
Right.
Yeah. Some of these shows, it's great. But the other reality is they're also training the other side. So all the folks that show up con with all of this information and all of this elevated understanding, the one T-shirt at Crime Con that I love that says basically a detective, pretty close. I mean, some of these folks that are watching First 48 and, you know, all the CSI shows and Cold Justice, they're hearing it. They know what they're talking about. They have good ideas and they're correct in their summations and their theories.
But that can also...
They're training perpetrators too.
Right.
They're listening to them. So if you're telling somebody how to get over on a polygraph, to get over on DNA, leaving that behind, or, you know, how do you make sure the victim's cell phone's not being tracked. You're training the wrong people, too.
For the benefit of the listeners, explain what an MVAC is. We referenced the machine and the technology, but offer us a thumbnail on what MVAC is and what it does.
Imagine a shrunk-down version of a steam cleaner. And so what this machine does, it has sterile water and pristine hoses and cups and everything that it needs. And it has this nozzle that when placed on an item, clothing, a rock, a jump rope, a broom, whatever it is, shoots water down pretty ferociously and at the same time sucks it right back up. So it's collecting 200 times more than your buccal swab ever could. And it's doing so in a way that you're going to get a fuller sample. So a lot of times you hear like, oh, we got a partial DNA. Well, with the MVAC, you're going to get a solid DNA sample. And what it does is it puts it in this little cup, and then it filters it through this little, you know, pad, as it were. And what is left there is like the tip of your cotton swab, but it's the size of a Petri dish. And it is all the DNA off of that rock or shirt or pants or done a broomstick or whatever, like this.
So it's a real game changer in terms of what kind of DNA you can get from a scene.
It is absolutely a game changer, specifically for me with cold cases, active cases as well. But if you've got a case where let's say they only tested the victim's coat, they go back and test the blouse. And they've had rust in 40-year-old cases, 30-year-old cases, 28-year-old cases. Like every week, there's something the MVAT has done to solve a cold case. It's remarkable.
And Mac, before we let you go, we do want you to speak a little bit about the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. So can you talk to our listeners a little bit about what that is and what your relationship sure. is to it?
Sure. I'm the director and founder of it because when I was teaching college, I was teaching from 6 p.m. to 10 o'clock. I had worked all day. They had worked all day. And it was real difficult to keep the students engaged for 4 hours after working all day. And especially when it's like criminal theory and all that kind of statistics and stuff that you have to have that's going to be really cool when you get to that part of an investigation. But when you're just learning the basics of it, it can be pretty horrible. So anyway, I was working at the Sheriff's Department in Spalding County at the time. So I asked these stewards, can I please take this particular double homicide? And I will redact all the victim information that, and just see if my students can do anything with it. He thought it was a great idea. So the next night, I walk into class, and I literally dropped the murder box in the middle of the room. Everything had been redacted. And I said, this is your case for this entire semester. Good luck. And you have to use every single thing from every single chapter of our book.
Wow.
But as a teacher, I can tell you that that is fantastic.
And it's a real case.
All I had to do was get out of the way. I had students that before didn't want to talk about DNA, would not have written a 3-page paper. They're basically giving me a thesis on it. I had students that had researched and written and contacted people and asked me if I could bring in this expert or that expert. So at the end of that semester, I'm like, Mac, you might be on to something. So I called my bud over at Lou Harris over at Faulkner University. And Lou is a former FBI agent. And I called Linda Wright, who runs the program over at Auburn University of Montgomery. And I said, listen, I got an idea. How about the three of us? Because Lou was teaching profiling and Linda was teaching crime scene, and I was teaching criminal investigation. And I said, what about if the three of us use the same case at the same time separately? I don't want to talk to y'all all semester. Y'all don't talk to me. Don't talk to each other. At the end of it, let's see what all three groups came up with. And we did that. And we realized we might really screw up and solve something. So then the three of us contacted other colleagues at other colleges. And it just matriculated into this really cool thing where we worked Natalie Holloway. And Natalie, you know, Beth came and helped us, and we understood Natalie, and we understood the crime scene. And Dawn Skinner, one of our experts, went to Aruba and walked the scene and sent us pictures back and everything. And we're the group that predicted that he would reoffend in 5 years. And, of course, he did by killing Stephanie Flores, which is really horrible. But we were like, okay, that's solid work. And we did that with these students that did the majority of the work. And then we turned it into a 501c3 so that we could raise money to do more things. We worked Boston Strangler, and that had a significant outcome for us. We worked Chandra Levy, which at the time we were solid by, and we still stand by. And we've worked Chanda Turner, Mary Shotwell Little. I mean, we've worked some pretty significant cases by Ripken, Cal Ripken's mother, when she was kidnapped. We've worked a ton of high-profile cases, and we've worked a ton of cases nobody's ever heard of. In every single case, we have moved it in some way. So I teach the students, we don't use the word solved all the time, because you're not going to solve them all. And that's the lesson, too. You're not. I don't know why. Okay, there's a million reasons why. I firmly, personally believe that maybe we're not supposed to solve them all. And I'm real open about this, but I'm Episcopalian, and I believe that good things come, and you're supposed to see the good. So the example that I use a lot with the students is Amber Hagerman. And Amber Hagerman is a 9-year-old girl who's just riding a bicycle, y'all, with her grandparents and her mama and her brother. and her mama and the grandparents still in the house, and they say, stay with your brother, like everybody always said. Y'all stay together.
Right.
I say it to my older children. Y'all stay together. And she did. But a truck pulls up and literally grabs her off that bicycle, and she is gone. I do not know why that child had to be assaulted like that and ultimately murdered. I do not know. But I do know this. Amber Hagerman has solved over 1,000 cases, and she has taken 1,200 bad people off the street. And that might just be the reason what happened to her had to happen. Because a 9-year-old little girl has saved 1,200 other children.
That's amazing.
That is remarkable.
It truly is.
So with you, Bill, I don't know why what happened to Kathy had to happen. I don't. But I know what you're doing with it.
Yeah.
And I know what this show is doing with it. And I know that you're telling everybody about being that. And I know you're trying to help other families that are navigating with the FBI and their State Department and their local department. I don't know why it had to happen. It's horrible. But I know the good that is coming from it. And that is what I'm going to concentrate on.
Well, thank you. Very much appreciated. That's probably as good a place as any to close out on.
Mac, thank you so much for joining us. You are amazing.
Well, and I just cannot wait to hug y'all in Orlando, and I just admire and love both of you.
Oh, well, thank you. We'll very much look forward to seeing you, and hopefully we'll get to Atlanta as well. And anything we can do with the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, count both of us in.
Absolutely. Oh, 100%. Absolutely.
Anytime y'all are coming, we'll do a wine and crown around y'all. Let's just have some fun. Anytime.
Thank you. We'll talk soon then.
All right. Thanks so much, y'all.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, Mac.
That wraps it up for this episode of Mind Over Murder. Thanks again for listening. And as a reminder, please subscribe, rate us, and review us. We are a new podcast, and your subscription, rating, and reviews are critical to our success. And please tell your friends about Mind Over Murder. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
Mind Over Murder is a production of Absolute Zero and Another Dog Productions.
Our executive producers are Bill Thomas and Kristen Dilley.
Our logo art is by Pamela Arnois.
Our theme music is by Kevin MacLeod.
Mind Over Murder is distributed in partnership with Crawl Space Media.
You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
You can also follow our page on the Colonial Parkway Murders on Facebook.
And finally, you can follow Bill Thomas on Twitter at BillThomas56.
Thank you for listening to Mind Over Murder.